Good afternoon, everybody. Robin, are you here again? Good to see you. Good to hear from you. And thank you for joining me on today, another recording. I think that's the third one today, if memory serves me correctly. Nonstop since morning doing podcast recording. I really enjoy what I do. I have so much passion for talking to people and having conversation with people. And again, this channel, as you can notice, today I think we're recording episode 227. Only been around for 3 years, and this June we'll be celebrating our third year. So I'm looking forward to celebrating this channel with you guys out there. So thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. And before we get started here, I want to welcome my today's guest, Dilip Chetan. And Dilip, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward for the conversation. I've prepared various topics that we got to get into. But before we do that, for the audience, if you're new to the channel, and I hope you enjoy the content that I push out. And by the way, this is an army of one, to be honest with you. This entire channel is just one person. It's me. And I record, I edit, I post, I engage with people. But I truly appreciate the guests and the preparation they put through this. And I appreciate each and every guest that comes along to this channel. That's a testament to the good job that our listeners are interested in. They keep telling me this. They keep telling me how authentic conversation carry more weight than infomercial conversation. We're not broadcasting anything here. We're talking about serious topics. And before we get into it, thank you again for joining me on the recording, and let's get started. Dilip, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Robin. Thank you for having me. Really looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you. Dilip, where are you from?
Originally, I moved from India in the year 2000. College here. I have three master's degrees. I have an MBA, a master's in computer science, and a master's in something called human factors that actually deals with how human beings interact with machines. And it turned out to be very, very valuable to me because that's where I've spent the rest of my life and career.
And you're in the Bay Area, right? In
I live
California.
In the Bay Area. Correct. Yeah. I live in East Bay. I've been a Bay Area resident for about 21, going on 22 years now.
So what's the full story of your story? What got you here to where you are right now?
So I started working for the big tech industry here in Silicon Valley. I worked at Oracle, Salesforce, Intuit, Atlassian, helped a company called Bill.com with their IPO planning and all of that. And then also moved to Meta and Google. And really what got me to where I am right now with the defensible zone was when I sat back and thought about how, you know, this whole narrative of AI is taking over your jobs and it's coming for you. And I started to ask myself, is there a place that AI can't get to in my life as part of my career? And I mapped something out. And the more I looked at it, the more I thought, hey, this might be useful for a couple more people. I started running it by my colleagues, by my friends, and they all were like, we have no idea what, you know, I called it the defensible zone. And they're like, we have no idea what this is, what our defensible zone is. Like, we've been doing the same thing over and over again. We've been told, go to college, go to a good school, get a good degree, get into a job. It's a conveyor belt. You're going to retire happy. And that's no longer happening. So I also talked to young people, and that was very interesting because other than my own children, their friends who are finishing up their college or some are starting high school, one young person, actually my neighbor's son, went and said, I don't even know. I'm going to college to do this thing. I don't even know if I'm going to get a job when I finish it. What if that field is going to become redundant in the next 4 years? A very frightening thing for somebody who has, you know, all life ahead of them. And that's where I started to go, okay, this defensible zone thing needs to start working for people. Yep. They need to understand and introspect where they are, because a lot of people, including me, we found that we were not in our defensible zones. And that's why I started this business.
So because you mentioned, you know, Google, Meta, Salesforce, and a few of the other big hitter in the tech sector that you've worked for in the Bay Area, what did you understand about AI that most professionals still don't? Because you were on the inside, and I don't know if you're independent now. Are you still working for somebody, or are you independent now?
I'm fully independent now.
Yeah, okay. So was there anything on the inside of those organizations that you sort of the light bulb came on and you said, okay, well, a lot of people on the outside don't understand this. I'm going to, you know, spend some time thinking about it. What was that?
AI is not as powerful as people on the outside think it is. It is not a panacea. It's not a do-all. It has a lot of problems. This morning, I was joking with my wife about some of the things. I was writing some code, and I was joking on how bad and how the way it talks. A lot of people have assumed that AI is already so established that it can do everything human beings can. It cannot. And that is a critical thing for people to understand, especially when they go. I had a business owner approach me last week, and then he was looking for help from me, and I was asking, like, what is his goal? Like, what do you want to do when you talk about bringing AI into your organization? I was very surprised by his answer, where he went, I'm looking to cut down my workforce by at least 20%, and I want your help. And I went, that is the worst way to approach the problem. It is not.
But most people are thinking that way, Dilip, right? Most people are thinking that way now. It's a cost-saving thing.
Yes, it's a cost-saving thing, except when you start using AI, and you start using AI for everything that a human being is doing, those tokens start to add up. And
you know, I do an AI exchange. It's a networking event. It takes place on Friday morning. You're welcome to attend, by the way, if you're ever interested.
Thank you.
It's 9 o'clock. Probably it's too early for you in the Bay Area, but 9 o'clock Eastern. But one of the things we're talking about this morning, and I did a little bit of a presentation for the group, is that instead of thinking about AI from a cost savings perspective, how about flipping this around and think about it from a revenue generation, an opportunity creation, a market penetration area. So market areas that probably I never thought about as an industry or as a company. Now I can use AI to explore the possibility of either growing my business, increasing my customer base, make my customer more happy with the services I offer, right?
I think that's absolutely spot on, because they're not thinking about how do I improve the productivity of my existing workforce. They've already decided that these people can't do what AI is doing, or AI can do what they're doing better. And it's really scratching the surface there, but they already made a decision that, okay, I'm going to, like, that's a number. The way when you approach somebody and you go, I want to cut off 20% of my workforce, how can you help me? And I go, what made you decide that you don't need 20% of your workforce? So you've done some math in your head that goes, this is what is happening. This is the work they're doing. This work AI can do, so they're out. What made you limit those people only to that? And in a lot of companies, people are pigeonholed into things. They're capable of doing much, much more, but you're pigeonholed into doing something. And you, the sad part is, you come to believe after a few years that that is all you are inherently capable. And that's where the danger lies, is, you know, you believe it so much. When other people are telling you that, you're like, yeah, I can't do anything anymore. I talk to so many people that are like, yeah, no, this is all I can do. I'm like, so you're done? You're giving up? Is that it?
Yeah, you're finished.
You're finished?
You know, I did a podcast with, you mentioned the young people earlier. I did a podcast with a young man. He's like barely 18 years old, from Montreal. And you mentioned something about kids going to school nowadays and just, you know, making a decision. It's a question mark. Should I continue? Should I not continue? And even if I continue, am I going to get a job? So this person has quit job, school completely, 100%. Started a new AI company that I'm not sure you're familiar with Shark Tank. Similar idea. He calls it Fish Tank. And it's based on pitching your idea to venture capitalist or venture capital companies and people via social media. So you create an idea, you promote it on social media. Venture capitalists are on social media, obviously, like the rest of us. And if they see something they like, they pitch an amount for you. And I was a skeptic at the beginning when I heard the conversation. I said, is this working now? He said, yeah, that's how I got my first VC money. I said, how much money did you get? In the millions. So I wanted to validate it. So I asked who the person was. He gave me the name. I connected with that individual on LinkedIn and he validated it. So that person, age 18, decided, what am I in it for? Am I going to go to school? What am I going to study? Unless you study or you learn some hand-based profession, you know, a plumber, carpenter, construction. I don't know. Are we going to get to a point where robots are doing all that stuff for us? Less likely. Maybe. I don't know. But the future is down the road. The first big impact for AI, and I did a couple podcasts on this one, and I'm sure you agree with that, knowledge-based industry. Anything within the knowledge-based economy is being impacted. That's the first target, number one. Now, there are some companies are experimenting or not as much proliferated with robotics. There was a company here in Toronto, what's it called? Jet something, I can't remember. They were going to do a podcast with me. They haven't done it yet. Their CEO talks about, you know, a customer comes in and says, I need to hire two individuals to lift a box from this conveyor belt, put it onto the truck, or lift from this conveyor belt and put it on another conveyor belt. So this company does is create these machines to replace those two individuals. I mean, with lack of employees, I guess, or employees with a specific skills or repetitive movement that you are going to cause injuries in some cases for the long-term exposure. I think they're starting to do some work there, but not as proliferated. The number one target for AI right now is a knowledge-based economy.
100%.
Is that what you're seeing on your side?
I'm seeing the exact same thing. And that is the difference between AI and the other technologies that came that we thought would upend and disrupt everything, like the internet, or all these had clear guidelines, clear borders, and they were not coming for knowledge. They were coming for specific skills or tasks. And we mastered those tasks. That was it. We had upgraded ourselves now with the knowledge of doing those tasks with the device or technology, and we were golden. That's not the case now, because when it comes for knowledge and cognition, that's coming for our identity. That's coming for who we are. And it's squeezing the middle, which is AI is already very good at automating the average. And it is forcing us to become better versions of ourselves, because the average can now be done by AI pretty well. And, and to the point you raised about the young person who's started a VC, I think everybody is now looking for funding, especially here in the Bay Area. The trick is to append the letters AI after anything you're doing. And they're like, okay, I got $10 million by this evening. I'll have the money, right? That's the kind of thought. And you'd be shocked at how many people are also leaving their existing day jobs on their own because they've decided that that's it. And they're starting their own businesses. And well, I have two sort of reactions. One is great. I love entrepreneurs. I've run a preschool with my wife for more than 15 years. I know what it's like to be, and I know what it's like to be, how difficult it is. And it's not for the faint of heart. And I always wonder at, you know, this person had difficulty with a 9-to-5 job in a big company, and they're thinking they can now do a startup consultancy. More power to you, but please do your homework. And
you're absolutely correct. Like, I just left a corporate job in November last year, where I was president and general manager for a company here in the Toronto area. And I was managing Canada for the company. And after like 25 years doing this, and now I am independent on my own. And I'm telling you, people are looking at me. They thought, because I left my corporate job, everybody think I retired. I'm not retired. And I'm just breaking the news to everybody again. I'm not retired. I'm still working. But I'm more working now than I ever worked before. I'm putting a lot more hours. I'm working on the weekend. I'm working in the afternoons, late in the evening. You know, work never stops, it seems, for me. Two things. One is, when you quit your corporate job, and you probably can attest to that because you've done the circuit, you are experiencing a little bit of a freedom. The freedom to think, the freedom to operate. You're not obligated to work under what I call red tapes of corporate structures. You are the corporation. You can decide whatever you want to do, which leaves you a lot of freedom, a lot of room, a lot of ideas. That's what I'm noticing right now. Many balls in the air. I have many initiatives on the go, and each one of them are equally important in my mind. It's stupid, but equally important. I got to do a priority list. I don't. Now, when is that how it worked for you? Like, when you left, you immediately went and opened Recursio Lab, or that took you some time?
That took me some time. I wanted to start a medical product. I wanted to start a product that does, when you meet your doctor, at least here in the United States, and this might be a problem only in the United States, where a doctor is expected to spend only minutes with you, and I meet them twice a year. They have no idea, like, other than what they're seeing on Epic, they have no idea what my situation is. So I thought it would be amazing.
What is Epic, by the way? Sorry, what is Epic?
Epic is the system that pretty much it's an enterprise system for keeping all your database about you.
You mean like the medical database?
The medical database.
Okay, so that's your patient record and all that stuff?
It's all your patient records and everything. It's an electronic data repository. So they take a look at it and they go, here are your numbers and here's your medication. All right, your numbers look good. I'm going to adjust it a little bit and I'll see you after 6 months. And I went, well, that's not the conversation or the quality of conversation I want to have. So I built a product that'll let me do like a quick one pager that really synthesizes what's really going on with me. And I showed it to a whole bunch of doctors and they loved it. But then I started hitting roadblocks with Epic and some big systems like that, getting into HIPAA and the FDA stuff. You know, it's not, that was not easy. And then I started pivoting toward other things. And this one is my third pivot. And this one is sticking, because I'm getting tons of feedback from small businesses, from working people alike. In fact, I've not yet answered two people that ping me today saying, I need your help. So it's one of those things where I felt like, yeah, I need to help small businesses as a small business owner myself on two different fronts. I need to help them and figure out where their defensible zone is and what they're doing. And that's where, you know, that's how I came about and landed where I had.
So which leads us to defensible zone, I guess, which we talked a little earlier about it. So let's get into this framework, if you don't mind. You say the wrong question is, what can I do that AI can't? That's actually the question that I hear most, I guess, everybody ask. Why is it wrong to ask that question, in your opinion, which you alluded to earlier?
Because that question, usually the answer to that question comes in the form of a bunch of skills. And currently what people, the big narrative is, oh, you learn how to use AI, you learn to use this tool, that tool. There are a million training programs out there that'll teach you this. But that's really kicking the can down the road. 6 months later, well, if you ask me what I think is going to happen in the next couple of years, products may not exist. It's all going to be AI. It's going to do everything for you. You don't even need a specific product. And the things that you thought you had to do can now be done by agents without any intervention from you. When that kind of situation is happening, what are you going to do upgrading your knowledge on how to use specific products and tools? It's not a long-standing solution. The longer-standing solution is where you're going to really dig deep into yourself and understand, what part of me is AI not able to reach right now, and how can I strengthen that point? That's where the defensible zone comes from. And to just give you a quick overview of the framework, everybody has a set of capabilities. That's everything you're capable of doing as a human being. Within that, you have a subset of skills. These are the things that you do well or have been trained to do. Within that, you have what I call natural affinity. I'll give an example. For a sports person, the natural affinity is to play that particular game on the field. And they love the game so much, they put their hearts into it. This is what drives them. This is who they are. And it stays with them even after they age out of the sport. Like, you always see people, like, they were amazing sports people, but now that they've aged out, they still stay in that vicinity. They either become coaches, they become commentators, they become writers. Like, they are still in the sport. They're just not playing on the field. That's their natural affinity. That's who they are. And there is some natural affinity that every human being has. And identifying that and being passionate about that and getting into that and developing that is something that AI is still not able to reach. Now, am I saying AI cannot touch your natural affinity? No, that's not what I'm saying. If you look at the picture I put on my website, AI has already eaten a little bit into that. But that's where you got to be. And I'd love to talk about, you know, localization and language, because there's a lot to unpack in there, but I'll just stop by saying, and I'll wait for questions from you, by saying that identifying the intersection between natural affinity and market demand and keeping this in the background of where AI is encroaching, that space is your defensible zone.
So we talk about a defensible zone, and we talk the antidote to that is the evolution of technology, which is continuous. It's a self-learning technology. It's not waiting for the next revision or next version update, like we used to do with Windows, Windows 10, Windows 11, etc. This is continuously evolving daily. So when you talk about a defensible zone, how do you balance that with the evolution of technology? Is defensible zone a fixed border, or is it an erosion at a slower pace?
It is not a fixed border. It is eroding at a slower pace, but you don't have to stay in the same spot. You can move. In fact, you must move your defensible zone in relation to two things: market demand and AI growth. Market demand is also dependent on AI growth. Today's market wants things that it did not want last year. And that's because market has woken up to what else AI can do. So when you're playing this game, you have to be, it's like, I'm sorry to use a sports analogy, but it's like playing football in America, where you're looking at not just where you need to throw the ball, but who is coming to attack you and take the ball away from you. It's happening simultaneously. So while you're firing that arrow to where you need to go, you're also recognizing that you don't have a lot of time to think and fire. It's got to be done quickly. You got to pivot. And that is the key word here, is pivot. Be ready to pivot at a moment's notice. Increase your awareness to an extent that you are able to understand what's next, what's coming down the line and become that person that is able to pivot as quickly as possible.
Now, one of the things that we talk about on this channel is finding the value of each individual in this space. So when you combine technology and human, you're always going to have people saying, well, you know, I can get this done by technology. And the question becomes is, well, yeah, you can do it by technology, but how do you know it's right? And in fact, in the localization industry, that's a debate on a daily basis. Example, if you are not a subject matter expert in something that you are trying to use technology to help you with, what is your measure of judgment? I don't think you have any. Example, I receive an email and in Korean, I can get AI to translate it for me in English so I understand what's in it. I try to respond back in Korean. I have no absolute way to judge what is AI told me in that email. Am I insulting my audience? Am I telling them to F off? I have no idea. The AI that came out, it's in Korean. I have no way to judge it. And now I'm going to take it as a, you know, standard, and I'm going to put it, cut and paste it, put it into an email and send it to somebody. Fingers crossed, it well received. And if it's not well received, here's another relationship burnt. The value, finding the value where human are, I'm assuming that's what you're alluding to in the defensible zone, is that area where always you need a human to add that the human aspect of the professional knowledge into the technology. And the fact that we're moving the needle by technology adapting and evolving and learning, either with two things, either we stand still, which is not what you're saying, you have to continue moving. I'm assuming by moving, you mean I need to continue updating and upgrading my skills. So therefore I'm continuing learning and adapting down the road, because if I'm at standstill, I'm not doing anything. The knowledge I have, it's a matter of time before technology takes it. I mean, my earlier podcast, it was with a CPA, that's a chartered accountant here in the country. And we specifically talked about this one. Most accountants have their intellectual property in their mind. What is in your mind now can be compressed into an algorithm and put into a software from an accountant point of view. In fact, when I asked the question, let's say, you know, your tax laws changes, and they do change every few months or every year in all countries, not just Canada, United States. So how would we know how to update? Well, now the software or the AI in general would be able to tell me that there is a new update. I don't even have to tell it. There is a new update from the government. There's a new policy or there's a new law for taxes. And I went ahead and updated the rules automatically, and then everything is there. All this to say is that what you're promoting is open your eyes, know what you're good at, and try to figure out what am I good at and trying to continuously improve that. Did I get that right?
Absolutely. There are a few things that you raised, and I want to address them all. So this last sentence, I'll just respond to that first, and then I'll go back to other things you said, and I'll address them. Yes, you got that. It is not just, it is about that constant upgradation of yourself. It is where you're having that awareness on how I can keep upgrading myself. But I would also add one other component is you also need to be aware of what AI is doing in that space. Are you inadvertently upgrading to a place where AI already exists? And in this knowledge economy, that's kind of a tricky thing, right? Like, for example, Michael Pollan, you talked about back in many decades ago, we can know more than we can tell. Like, it's impossible for us to articulate everything we know. And that's the tacit knowledge that AI can't get to. Well, AI is getting to that. Now, I want to address a few things that you mentioned about, you know, using Korean. And I think that's one of the key things here, right, is where you want to understand in a conversation. And sometimes the stakes become high. Like, for example, if you're using a Korean honorific, what is applicable to a press release versus an apology? What is the right way to come across? The understanding of the culture, the understanding of the zeitgeist. And then within that, you have depths of how deep your stake is. Like, there's the accountability layer. If you're using translation for medical device labeling and being cognizant of FDA, the word concussion might mean something totally different. Like, I learned that the hard way when I was in the UK, you know, concussion means something entirely different in the United States as in the UK. We use concussion for other things, right? And when you're talking pharmaceutical patient information, lawsuits are involved, legal contracts, patent filings, language becomes extremely critical in that area. And I'm not going to trust AI with that kind of thing. There's also this, you know, other interesting thing. When you make a joke, culture is very important for you.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
That joke might fall flat and backfire on you. Just even if it's in the same language, just addressing somebody in Europe versus here. And again, I have some fun experiences there. And it was like, I it won't land. And I'll give an example. At Meta, I was working with Glyphs and Labels across for globalization of glyphs and labels. And the red heart emoji, which we use so flippantly here in the States, it has a different meaning in different cultures. You want to be careful using a red heart emoji when you're talking with a woman who is not your friend in India, for example, because that's recognized as a romantic gesture. And you want to be a little bit careful just sending out red hearts to people.
Thanks for telling me this.
Robin,
I don't know how many red hearts I've sent out. I'm in trouble already.
Right. And also the color red itself, like in China, has a very deep meaning and deep understanding. You want to be careful about how you're using those colors, the language, the thumbs down sign. Yeah, no, don't use it everywhere. Right. And
I can just imagine in some cultures, this would be completely offensive.
Yeah. Do a red heart and a red thumbs down. You're guaranteed.
We're done.
So where AI is coming from is the routine execution. It's, think of it like an hourglass. It's automating the average. So
yep.
Everything in the middle, and even the average employee in a company, right? If your job is in pigeonholed to do only that average task, then AI is coming for that. So you want to be thinking about the expert judgment, the accountability aspect. And in the language industry, I think it's no longer a volume game. And that is the biggest realization. It's not about, the amount you get paid per word of translation. That AI is already taken. So you want to be careful,
yeah.
Post-editing. People are like, oh, post-editing. Just like I hear, AI takes everything over. What's the solution? And they go, UBI, that'll take care of it. Really? Have you taken a look at our national debt? Have you taken a look at what it takes? Like, if you're earning $500,000 a year, you're going to give me $10,000 a year and say, UBI, go live a happy life. Really? Do you know what it costs to live a good life in the Bay Area?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Right? So it's like people throw these things around like, yeah, post-editing, UBI, you'll be fine. No.
Yeah. By the way, UBI is universal base income. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. That's
yeah,
what I was
talking about. Yeah. So I was just talking to somebody earlier about UBI, and we got into on this UBI thing, and only a few companies will own wealth. And, we're going into that now, and everybody else is going to be poor. And, UBI is the solution. So how much for UBI do you think they're going to give you? Like, are you going to get like half of Musk's money, or what do they think they're going to give you? They're going to give you basic income, basically, so you don't die. That's it. You can go to the grocery shop, but if you're driving a Tesla, that's on you. You're on your own with that one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and be careful what you buy in the grocery store, because those avocados, they can.
And probably there'll be like grocery stores, endorsed by government. Those are the type of food we're going to allow you to buy, and that's it. If you want to be rich, go to the other store.
Yeah, buy the generic Fruit Loops, and then don't add milk to it because the colors will run.
I love that one. Well, that's a nice joke. I really like it. I can imagine what happened afterward. Tell me, you make a distinction between affinity and passion. How do you define that? And can you talk a little bit about that?
Affinity is something that you are hardwired to do. Affinity is something that when you are in your affinity space, you are in flow. It just happens. Passion is something that you would like to do. You may or may not be good at it. I'm passionate about painting. I actually am. I'm not a good painter. I never went to art school. Anything you see hanging on my walls in my house, I did them. People admire them, but maybe they're admiring it because they're my friends. They don't want to offend me. Should they stay on the wall? I don't know, but I'm passionate about it. But my natural affinity is for doing things like the defensible zone. I feel at home doing this.
Yeah.
I feel at home talking and working with small businesses because I've done research with thousands, tens of thousands of small businesses in surveys. I've talked to more than 300, 400 small businesses across the United States. I've run one for 15 years. I understand the DNA. I've talked to so many people, Robin, that have lost their jobs in the past few weeks. I understand at a visceral level what it is and why something, a flippant answer like UBI will take care of you. Like, it is your purpose in life that we are taking away. It is your reason for existence. It is your identity. A job for most people is their identity. And even being in a company where layoffs are happening and surviving that, I was in a team of 16 people, 14 people were laid off overnight. The following morning, my team meeting had turned into a one-on-one. And I'm going, like, the feeling of emptiness and the survivor guilt was incredible. And people are like, what are you worried about? You kept the job. I'm like, no, you don't understand what it means to lose every single colleague that I was working with. This is more than just showing up, doing something and going home at 5. This is about relationships. This is who I am. right? Yeah. And to get into that, that is my natural affinity. So
there's the difference between affinity and passion, which is, you know, it's a big distinction. In the defense, you described the defensible zone as a place to make your next move, not a permanent safety. We already talked about that. That's an important caveat, because automatically when the name itself, defensible zone, people would start to think, if I'm inside the defensible zone, I'm good, I'm golden. But that's not what you're saying. You're saying you're in a zone now. You have to continue moving within that zone. Don't go outside of it. You have to continue moving in the zone. And rightly so, a fixed target is an easy target. So a moving target is pretty hard to get to. How do people avoid the trap of thinking that they found their safety net, their safety harbor, and then stop evolving? And that's what we talked about, the continuous learning, etc.
I think that's a very, very important question. And that's why I use the word defensible and not safe. It's only defensible. It's not a safe zone. So don't think that, you know, once you're in it, you're set for life. No, it's not. And for different people, some people's defensible zones might be bigger and might last them a longer time. Others' defensible zones might be squeezed out in the next 6 months. And to answer your question on how do you know that this thing is working, there's three kinds of defensibility that I'd like to talk about. The first one is like value defensibility, which is how clearly is the value of whatever it is that you're producing, product or service, how clear and uniquely distinguishable is that value? Can people tell you that this is what, if I may use you as an example, like Robin does this that no one else does. This is uniquely Robin. This is his voice. When you see the work, you can see his fingerprint, his DNA in it. The second is customer defensibility. And one way of testing it is change some of the levers. For example, it's all about how hard is it for your customer to leave you? So let's say you raise the price of whatever it is you're doing by 20% overnight. No warning, you just raised it 20%. How many people are going to leave you versus stay? What if you raise it 50%? Are people going to leave you? Is everyone going to leave you? Even if you raise it 5%? That's not really defensible then. So don't make the mistake of thinking you have a moat just because you have a bunch of customers that are coming to you, right? This morning I was looking at an idea where somebody had started a company, yet another company just like Evite. Yet one of my friends came when he heard about defensible zone, he didn't know what it was. He begged me, he said, please, please, please don't start another HR job finding company. Please don't do that. I beg you.
Yeah, exactly.
We need another one. And the third part of defensibility is the operational defensibility. And we talked about that. How much of your value, with your accountant example, lives in documented systems versus just in your head alone? And you think just because it's in your head, that's incredibly defensible. No, AI can come and make whatever it is in your head very cheap, very easy, very fast. It may do it at 80% efficiency, but 80% is good because it's 80 times cheaper.
Yeah. And it's the 80-20 rules, right? So as you know, like my audience in the industry, on the podcast here are from the localization services generally, translators, project managers, desktop publishers, those are the people that format the documents, language engineers, localization directors. There's many, many items in there. So it's like a $75 billion industry now. From your framework, how exposed is this industry? And where is AI already winning and where a human can still add value and become irreplaceable? Now, I've done a podcast with huge AI enthusiast and expert. She's got a couple of PhDs in various topics. And she is completely against the statement, you know, Silicon Valley solved the translation problem. That's the statement that's going around, and which a lot of people, professionals in our industry, disagree with that. And they disagree with it from the notion that you may have solved parts of the problem, not all the problem. So we solved the language problem is pretty broad. And, you know, in a precise world, you have to be a little bit more precise. Maybe we've solved the product management problem. Maybe we've solved the formatting issue. Maybe we've solved some bits and pieces of the use cases, not all of it. Can you speak to that?
Yes, I do not agree that Silicon Valley has solved the entire translation problem. When you get into nuance inside that, it has solved the problem for some people, depending on what their needs are. AI has taken over the routine execution and the rule-based codifiable tasks. Those are automated by traditional, which can be easily automated by traditional computing. I have a series of words in a sentence. I want you to spit out that same sentence in 10 different languages. I want to use that tomorrow on my website, just so somebody understands it. Now, for example, I'll give you what I mean. is if you're seeing instructions to put together a piece of furniture in a language, you're not going to lose your head over a grammar mistake or some word that makes no sense. You're just like, I still know how to attach the leg to the table. So it's okay if the language is not perfect. If you're doing that when you're doing customer outreach for a major project, you want to be really careful of all the things that we talked about. Are you leading with humor? Do they need to see your personality in it? What is the accountability there? What are the legal ramifications of saying something inappropriate? What is the, you know, and as the cost of the translation increases, that's the place where I feel like AI should not be allowed, not the state it is in right now. Tasks that require pattern recognition, you know, in terms of language, those are, you know, they aren't high stakes individually. That was historically predicted, like tacit knowledge, and AI is coming and taking that spot over. So I want to say conservatively 35-36% of the work of the industry is being serviced by AI in a satisfactory manner, and people are happy with that. Where it starts to get tricky is when you want expert judgment, expert decision making, something where durable human contribution is required, roles where somebody's signature, license, relationship, somebody's real knowledge comes into play and the stakes are really high. AI should not be allowed right now, because the more, and I'm sure you and I are in the same bucket, we use AI a lot, as you said, whenever you're doing a business of one, the more you use AI, the more holes you're seeing.
Yeah.
And you want to go, oh my God, I don't want to use AI for this. And that's one of the first things I advise people when they talk about getting into a defensible zone analysis done for them is, please use AI for everything so that you understand where I'm coming from. Don't assume AI can do every single task on the planet, because it cannot.
Yeah, that's right. You're absolutely correct. Now, is knowing or being fluent in multiple languages a defensible zone in your opinion? Or has machine translation perhaps commoditized that function? You know, let's say I speak three languages. Can I be considered in a defensible zone? Not many people speak three languages. I'm assuming most people in North America speak one language, maybe
yes.
Two.
Yes and no. I myself speak five. So the thing that is necessary to understand here is that language is not just verbiage. Language is culture. Language is identity. Language goes way deeper than that. So you can say the words to me, but you can't really understand my culture. You can, for example, you can, in Eastern cultures, it is polite for somebody to offer you food even when you're full. And the words are, you know, have more of this. That's the language. Have more of this translate to something very different in the United States. Versus
that's the argument between my wife there, Dilip. She's always saying have more. I said, I can't have any more. No, have more.
Exactly, right?
And she's Armenian, by the way. She's from the eastern side of the world.
Right. And so you're seeing, like, just in that sentence, the difference. Like, it's polite. It's, in fact, necessary. Like, if you've done business with anybody in Japan or China, you understand that it's multiple times you offer, they decline. You offer, they decline. You got to play the game. You do that in the States, they go, wait, you didn't get it the first time?
Yeah.
That means, no, that's it. I mean, I'm not interested, dude. Just get off my face, right? And it's so
it's interesting pretty blunt.
There. Yeah, it's pretty blunt, right? Australia is also very interesting because they kind of tell it directly. And that's, you know, we have so much difference between New York and California in the way we talk. I was actually part of a study where we talked about the gap that you leave between two sentences. Like when you say something, I leave a gap so that I let you finish politely. You nod and you leave a gap to understand when I finish. That gap is much shorter in New York than in California. So you feel like people are cutting you off in New York.
They talk over each other, I thought.
They talk over each other, just like I'm trying to do now.
No, I'm just kidding.
But that's because in their mental model, the gap is shorter. And how can just merely translating words help you there? It's much deeper than a language, represents a lot more. So when you say, I learned three languages, you probably learned three cultures. You probably learned three different identities. That's what's really making you defensible. Not just, I can translate X percent of words from one language to the other.
No, absolutely. I remember 2 years ago now almost, I got invited to speak or do a couple of workshops. I think a few workshops in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. And the workshops I did, they were on human in the loop in the language industry. And the students that were a part of the workshop, they were participating in the workshop, they were university students in the linguistic degree, just about to graduate. And like we're asking the question now, the same question has been asked for many years. 2 years ago, they've been asking the same question. Would I have a job by the time I graduate? Can I, you know, what is AI going to do to me? And I remember doing one of my slides. It has a sort of like, you know, a drug interaction statement from a drug, from a pharmaceutical company. It was in English. And I took that same statement and put it in Arabic. So I speak Arabic. I looked at the statement. Looks okay. It's translated correctly, in my opinion. Now I put that on the board and on the projector, and the room had many people. Like the auditorium was full of people. I can't remember how many. 200 people in the room, maybe. I have no idea. Everybody had their hands up. I said, my question was: this content is completely generated by AI. To me, I read it. It's okay. It does what it's supposed to do. To you, you here in Saudi Arabia, what is it saying to you? Literally, I had every hand up. And I had to cut the conversation short because each one of them was pointing at something wrong with that statement. Even though from the guy from the outside looking in, even though reading the language, and I grew up in a household that speaks Arabic. My parents are from Lebanon. I thought there's nothing wrong with the sentence. But from a cultural perspective, it was completely wrong, completely off. You don't ask, there you have to ask politely. You don't say take two pills per day. You would have to say, if you don't mind. And be polite in the way you ask. And I'm thinking, is that true? I just can't believe it. But that's true. That's the culture. That's what you need to deal with. It is not straight math. For those who think, and I've had a PhD doctor, he teaches AI for postgraduates in who's taking their PhD, or his candidate PhD in University of Lethbridge in Alberta, Sidney Shapiro. Great guy. And he tells me, like, you know, the understanding of where we are right now is, like what you were saying, is completely off. There's a huge hype and there's where we are right now. And that cultural nuances, like when I arrived in Saudi Arabia, remember, it was the year of the camel. Okay, so how do I know that? How does AI know that? Year of the camel. How do you translate that into your content? How do you embed this into your content? How do you take that cultural nuances, 4,000 or 5,000 year old, and put it into an AI translation, even if you train it?
Exactly. I mean, imagine, right? Friday, for instance, has a special meaning to certain cultures. Just the day Friday. You're setting up a meeting on Friday to do something. There's an underlying thing that you're communicating to that person if you're meeting with them on a Friday. And are you cognizant of that? Or did you just throw a meeting on somebody's calendar on a Friday afternoon and go, yeah, they look free, I'll do this.
Yeah, that's right. And then you get in trouble.
Right. I mean, things like these are, I mean, they've been there, to your point, for thousands of years, and people are sensitive to that. And it means, these things mean something else to people. The word please, the word thank you are two very, very critical words, how you use them and where you use them. And the manner.
Somebody told me a long time ago, sorry to interrupt you, but somebody told me a long time ago, they said to me, look, we're at the start of statistical machine translation and neural MT and all these types of technology were coming out. He said, Robin, let me tell you this. And that gentleman has been a linguist all his life. He was like ready to retire at the time. He said, languages are not mathematical formula, because the way we communicate as a human, we have many nuances. And we're not talking about ordering a beer at a bar. I mean, this is when people think about languages in North America. They think about it. I'm traveling to Spain. I need to order a taxi. How do I order a taxi? That's not the level of communication we're talking about. We're talking about a true human to human communication with full understanding of the context, full understanding of the heritage, full understanding of the nuances that makes the other human who they are. It's not a simple messaging.
No, it's not. And you're absolutely right. It's not an A, B, C type thing, A to B to C communication. It is that understanding the nuances. And let me add one more layer of complexity. Oftentimes, you're not the person directly communicating with a person from another culture. Oftentimes, you use somebody to mediate that communication because you are so overloaded. Now you're bringing in another entity in the middle. Yeah. And we have no idea what. It's a game of telephone with the most serious consequence.
Game of telephone, you're right.
And you're like, wow, now I don't know what that other person said. I told them to say this. And they're like, but this is what I thought you wanted me to say. And I translated it because in my culture, this means this. And they were going, oh.
Now, if a localization director out there are listening to this right now and want the position and their team as irreplaceable to their organization or to their customer, for that matter. I mean, organization is a customer. In the next 3 years, what is the most important conversation they should be having right now, do you think, internally?
They need to understand two things. One is where they stand right now. And for that, I gave a little bit of a framework: their value defensibility, the customer, and the operational defensibility. How clearly and uniquely the value is that they're providing, how hard is it for customers to leave them and why, and how much of it lives in individual people's heads. The second part of the conversation needs to focus on three things. One is the prompt or the domain layer, which is what is the meaning of certain words in certain cultures and understanding what applies to what kind of jurisdiction and what domain. The second thing they have to be cognizant of is the accountability layer. They have to move into spaces where the accountability is much more, the stakes are much higher, the consequences are more severe. Legal contracts, patent filings, financial disclosures, pharma, medical device, that kind of stuff. The last mile is the third one, which is the last mile cultural adaptation. Like you know, we were talking, right? AI can just make a translation. It cannot tell you that the joke in your that you're saying is not going to land. The colors that you, so there's way more layering into that. So those are the three areas where they really need to start focusing. And then saying, okay, you know, here's all the places where AI is doing. Also, I'm not saying run away from AI. Leverage AI, use AI to make you better, more efficient, faster, cheaper. But make sure that the human in the loop element is really powerfully articulated. And if that does not happen, then if it's only AI, too bad. If it's only human, too bad. Neither of them can exist independently. It's got to be an AI plus human in the loop. So that's,
and you can't, and people can't sail to the sunset yet. We still have a job to do.
No, unfortunately, no. And if the UBI talking people are not going to give their personal money to contribute to the UBI, then the sunset's pretty far off. It's still early.
Oh, 100%. And again, I mean, for every government program out there, which I don't know, it's mainly funded by taxpayers. They're not, you know, unless there's something else out there that I don't know about. Of course, there's the factor of printing money. But in any case, generally speaking, it comes from taxpayers. Eventually, somebody runs out of people, other people's money. Eventually. Now, yes. Let me ask you short questions toward the end here, if you don't mind, Dilip.
Please.
The most, what do you think of the most overhyped thing that in the AI work conversation, work and AI conversation right now, what is the most overhyped?
The capacity and ability of AI to do everything that people can do, and the fact that it'll displace a fiercely, phenomenally high percentage of jobs within the next few months. This is way overhyped.
Yeah. And what is the one skill that every professional should be building right now? Human, not technical.
It is judgment, just judgment. Understanding judgment and decision-making, the ability to do that. A lot of companies haven't empowered their employees with this. Companies have really dropped the ball on training their employees. They're too busy thinking who else to lay off next rather than developing those core skills that people have forgotten. And they've pigeonholed people into doing things that even they have convinced themselves, this is all I can do. So really taking a long, hard look at that and saying you're capable of doing way more than even you think you are. And that all comes down to judgment and understanding and that deep cognitive thinking that, you know, I don't know about the AGI, ASI conversation. That's another concept for a different conversation. But yeah, right now we are the thinkers and we need to be at the helm of affairs.
Do you have a book or a resource or a person that shaped how you think? Can you share that?
Yeah, actually quite a few. Nassim Taleb talked about anti-fragility, and it's not just about, you know, becoming more resilient. It is about thriving in uncertainty, thriving in chaos, like understanding that. That's one of the things. I'm a big fan of Ellen Langer's work. I know it's not directly applicable, but the power of the mind and what she talks about, you know, when you're talking about healthcare and whatnot, is AI cannot do what the power of mind can do. It's really interesting that people are talking about visualizations and, you know, manifestations now as one of the things. And AI can't do those manifestations and visualizations for you. You got to do it yourself. So leaning on the power of the human mind becomes much more critical and central. So it's kind of, some of those are being shaped by thinkers like that.
Absolutely. And before we close, if you don't mind, you made a significant career shift to work on what you're working on, Defensible Zone, full-time. That takes certain kind of conviction. What would you say to someone who's our audience right now who knows perhaps they need to reinvent something, but it hasn't made the move yet?
I would say, don't just say things like, I want to start a company. That is, or anybody, for anybody that says, I want to make money, or I want to not work for a boss anymore. Those are the wrong reasons to start a company. you got to have a purpose first. You got to figure out your place in society and what you're going to be doing. Understand for yourself what the exact problem is that you're going to solve. Understand how you're going to be unique in solving that problem. Unless you answer these things, do not start a company. It's not about getting the next funding. It's not about telling people that you're now the owner of a startup company.
Yeah. What problem are you solving? I want to thank you so much, Dilip. That was a great conversation. What do you think? Did you like it?
I loved it. Thank you so much, Robin. And I'll take you up on, you know, the community meetings and whatnot. I don't know if you're LinkedIn yet, but I think we should.
If we're not connected, let's do that. Let's connect on LinkedIn. Send me a LinkedIn connection if you don't mind, and I'd be happy to connect with you.
I will do that. Thank you so much, Robin.
Well, I want to thank you, Dilip Chetan, for joining me today. I really appreciate it. It was a fun conversation, very educated. I got a lot out of it, and I'm sure the audience the same. I hope it landed well with many of our audience as well, too, because this conversation, we need to keep it on the air quite often now. Because it's demystifying a lot of ideas out there that are either wrongly put in our brains and it's shaping our behavior based on the wrong ideas. So I want to thank you so much for bringing this to light and bringing that message out to all of our audience. Thank you so much.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity, Robin. Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it. For the audience, I want to thank you so much for joining me on this podcast recording with Dilip. And also, I want to thank you for watching us on YouTube, on our audio channels, and reading the blog on robinayoub.blog. I really appreciate your time with me today, and I will see you at the next episode. Thanks so much, everybody. Talk to you later.